This is an ABC podcast.
We should take the opportunity wherever we can to encourage kids to talk about their aspirations, their dreams, what they really would like to do. It's that whole idea that it takes a village to raise a kid. Well, it takes a village to value education.
Closing the gap between city and country when it comes to children completing high school and equivalent training. And the country's first glass bridge at Cobalt Gorge in Queensland, making the outback more accessible, especially for those with a sense of adventure.
There's only 9.5 metres of actual glass bottom floor. It's opening up many things, not just the other side of the escarpment, but also for people that could come out and conquer their fears.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. Firstly tonight, a 45-year-old Vietnamese woman has been expelled from Sydney Airport after biosecurity officers discovered a stash of undeclared pork and other food items in her luggage. In her first under new Australian biosecurity laws, the woman had her visitor visa cancelled for failing to declare food in her luggage. This comes at a time of heightened concern for the pork industry, with the detection of African swine fever in countries close to Australia, such as Timor-Leste. Eden Heinonen has been following the story. Eden, what was this woman trying to import into Australia?
Yes, hi Alex. She was found at Sydney Airport over the weekend. Now, she was found with not only 4.6 kilograms of pork, but 470 grams of eggs, along with kilograms of quail, pate, fruit, garlic and squid. And this is the first overseas traveller being expelled from an Australian airport. Now, this might sound minor, but we're talking about a contagious disease for the African swine fever that has wiped out 25% of the world's pig population. Now, it's not only a concern for the possible outbreak, but also that international travellers think it's okay to transport that amount of produce, particularly pork, in Australia.
Can you talk us through African swine fever? What is the threat from this disease?
Well, in China, Alex, there have been mass live pig burials with millions of culls, and it's just completely destroyed the Chinese pork industry. They said that they'll sell livestock feed, but sales are down by 80%. And it's not just in China, it's travelled through all of Southeast Asia, and it's even evident as close as 680 kilometres north of Darwin in Timor-Leste. So it's a real threat. And if it does come into Australia, we've got a $5.3 billion industry that could be impacted. The ABC spoke to the Australian Pork CEO, Margot Andre, who commanded the pork discovery at the airport. She said recently they've done testing in the last 2 weeks and there were 157 seizures that covered 418 individual products, and almost 49% of those products had ASF. So it's a bit of an alarming number.
So how does the disease travel?
Well, it's a viral disease of pigs that can spread rapidly with infected pigs or pig products, and through contact with contaminated vehicles, equipment, feed or clothing. According to Agriculture Victoria, the virus is able to survive in extended periods in raw, processed and frozen meat and meat products. So if you think about the number of people that are bringing products, and what I said before about, you know, imported meat and products from places like China and Southeast Asia, think about the number of that that's coming into our airports. So it's a large concern.
And what's been the reaction from the Federal Agriculture Minister, Bridget McKenzie, in regards to this case?
Well, she spoke publicly today about the African swine fever being potentially the worst animal health disease the world has ever seen. So it's quite a big call there, Alex. And she said that they've tightened immigration legislation so that international visitors who do bring in undeclared high-risk items can be sent back home. Not only that, but they can be refused entry to Australia and have their visas cancelled for up to 3 years.
Let's have a listen to the Agriculture Minister.
We need to keep our pest and disease-free status as a country strong, and with the threat of African swine fever reaching across Europe in the last 8 months, right throughout Southeast Asia, ensuring that our pest and disease-free status from this disease, which some say is potentially the worst animal health disease the world will ever see, from our shores. Australia has 2,700 pig producers. Nearly 36,000 Australians are employed in this industry, and we need to make sure It does not have African swine fever in it.
Federal Agriculture Minister Bridget McKenzie there. And Eden, obviously there is this case, but can you give us a sense of what authorities are finding?
Yes, Bridget McKenzie did say that since they've increased border checks, they've been seizing 100 kilograms a week of illegal pork products between November and 2018 and August 2019. Over 27 tonnes of pork were intercepted on air travellers around Australia. So if you think about that, along with a spokesperson for the Federal Agricultural Department said that ASF has been detected in around 50% of pork products stopped at international airports. That's up from 15% from about 9 months ago. So it's figures like this are also stressing out a lot of farmers. I've been recently travelling out just doing some stories, and I've spoken to some Tasmanian farmers who've had pigs on their property, and when I've asked to go near them, they've asked me if I've been around any other pigs in the country or overseas. So I know that people it's on their mind and are thinking about what could happen.
Obviously some heightened concern there. Eden Heinonen, thank you so much for bringing the story to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I don't want to put a killjoy on their fabulous family tradition, but
that was just mayhem and chaos.
The majority of them are still buying their trees, regardless of the snake.
So this is the first time we've opened the slide this summer.
On ABC Radio.
With the final school term of the year underway, the federal government's Australian Institute of Health and Welfare recently released its snapshot of secondary education in Australia. And it shows that while Year 12 retention rates are increasing across the board, children in regional and rural Australia are being left behind. The stats, only 1 in 10 city kids misses out on Year 12, compared with 2 in 10 regionally, and more than 3 in 10 in remote areas. While kids leave school for a number of reasons, evidence shows that not completing Year 12 or the equivalent means young people are more likely to do it tough throughout life. The Community Council for Australia is campaigning to end the educational disadvantage of young Australians in regional and rural areas. CEO David Crosby joins me. David, why is it so important for children to stay in school right through to Year 12?
Well, it's Year 12 or equivalent, so we should say that at the start, Alex, because not everyone needs to necessarily complete Year 12 in a traditional high school or a technical school. Sometimes people can do the equivalent Cert 3, Cert 4 kind of studies in trades and elsewhere, and these figures include that. So we're not just talking about completion of Year 12, we're talking about completion of Year 12 or its equivalent. And the reason that kids need to do one of those things is that otherwise they're likely to face very significant disadvantages throughout their lives. In fact, the economic cost to the community for every child that doesn't complete Year 12 or its equivalent is around $950,000 each. So we know that kids are more productive, they're more healthy, they're more likely to live fulfilling lives if they've actually completed Year 12 or its equivalent.
Why do you think we're seeing that difference between the cities and regional and rural Australia as far as children going on to complete Year 12 or the equivalent, as you say?
Well, it varies enormously. Sometimes kids are in really tricky situations where going to school has just become impossible. You know, there can be difficulties at home, they can be struggling to find the time or the access to school that's necessary, usually because they're in kind of challenging life situations. But there's also quite a lot of kids who just don't complete because they lose interest or feel as though it's not for them or can't see why they would bother or you know, complete all the work required to do that. And I guess for us, one of the really critical issues is the degree to which these kids are being provided with opportunities and the degree to which the people around them, you know, the broader community in which we live, value education and encourage kids to aspire and try and achieve things beyond what is available within their immediate environment. So sometimes it takes somebody seeing that, you know, even though there's no theatre in their area, they could still be a theatre producer, or, you know, there's no major manufacturing in their area, they could still be an engineer, or, you know, it's that sense of being able to look beyond your immediate horizon.
As I mentioned, research shows that those not completing high school or the equivalent are more likely to do it tough throughout their life. What can this look like?
Well, often these kids sort of disappear. We don't really see them for a while. So they're on the school roll up to, say, year 10 or year 11, and then they're in no formal institution. They're not in training, they're not in work, they're not in other kinds of options, including different kinds of schools. So we don't really see them, but often then they reappear in other statistics as longer-term unemployed, kids who are experiencing more chronic health problems, their mental health problems, kids who are starting to appear in the justice system. And, you know, they become bored, they become involved in you know, things like car theft and petty crime. And if we can positively engage these kids in school or its equivalent, allow them, encourage them, support them in dreaming big, the whole community benefits, not just the kids.
So, David Crosby, what then can we do, and what does the Community Council want to do to help close this gap between retention rates in education between city and country children?
Well, there's lots of things we can do in terms of making sure that kids can get access to quality education. And, you know, there are roles here for education. There's roles here for local providers of transport and public transport in particular. There's roles for carers, support, and all those kinds of issues. But perhaps more importantly, all of us as adults have contact with kids. You know, we may be an uncle or an aunt or an employer or a coach or a neighbour or someone who shops with at a supermarket where kids service. I think we should take the opportunity wherever we can to encourage kids to talk about their aspirations, their dreams, what they really would like to do. It's that whole idea that it takes a village to raise a kid. Well, it takes a village to value education.
And obviously not everyone will go on to university necessarily, but just looking at university, in 2015, 59% of Metro students expected to go to uni once they finish school, but only 39% of remote students saw themselves doing this further study. What concerns do you have with that difference in statistics?
Well, it's about expectation, Alex, and this is the issue, that there's less hope in regional and remote area Australia, less hope for people's future. And that's our responsibility. It's a little bit easier in the city where there are more options available and more role models of people doing different things and earning incomes in different, creative, exciting, challenging ways. There are a whole range of different expectations that come with having those people in your immediate environment. We often just point the finger at teachers or parents. Well, teachers and parents are part of a child's community, part of their village, but we're all part of children's villages as well. It's about encouraging every child to be a champion in some way, not the same way as the child next to them, but in their own way. And I think we can all make a difference in doing that.
David Crosby, wonderful to talk to you, CEO of the Community Council of Australia. Thank you so much for speaking to Australia Wide today. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I didn't know Melbourne much. I knew where the racecourses were.
I'm making signs for the sleepy lizards.
Basically less eggs this year than what we would have expected.
The houses that are near the edge of the bush, they might encounter a snake up to four times a year, a death adder.
See how it goes.
On ABC Radio.
And you're with me, Alex Hyman, here on Australia Wide. Great to have your company. To far north Queensland, where one of the state's largest and oldest piggeries is closing its doors as avocado trees replace the corn and sorghum crops that would have once fed their pigs. When George Greenwood started out in pig farming on the Atherton Tableland in Land of Cairns, he had 10 acres of land and 10 megalitres of water a year. It was enough for the enterprising young farmer to get a toehold in an industry that was on the cusp of massive expansion. But times have changed, and with it, so has the agricultural profile of the region, which was once a mosaic of corn and sorghum crops. As farmers planted avocado trees to capitalise on consumer demand, Greenwood's piggery found itself fighting a losing battle with spiralling grain costs. George Greenwood showed Charlie McKillop around the property that was nothing more than a ploughed paddock when he started out 49 years ago.
Usually you'd walk through here and one little pig would go, woof, and the rest would go, wow. They'd all stand up and yell out, hey, come back here. They're very social animals.
How does it make you feel, George, when you walk through your sow pens and you don't have that interaction to look forward to anymore?
Well, it's a very empty feeling, I can tell you. I mean, this has been our whole life for 50 years. As we turn into another shed here, you can see what an empty shed looks like.
Not quite empty.
Oh, these are the sole survivors, just the remnants. Hey, girls. I'll probably finish up in small goods somewhere, which is fine. That's because that's been our business, producing meat. I'll take you down to another shed. All the infrastructure you can see in here, Charlie, all the farrowing pens, we designed and built them ourselves.
Looking back, what did you consider to be the biggest challenge?
Marketing was always an issue. When I first started, the bacon factory in Mareeba was still operating. That was a co-op. There had been other enterprises operating. There was Williams over at Yungaburra, and they had a processing facility in Cairns. We have sold pigs to processors in Townsville, and another small producer myself. We had a crack at selling our pork pigs into Cairns. We did supply some of the major chains for a spell at different times.
You've talked about the fact that you do believe that pork prices will have their day, but you're not going to be around for that.
No, I'm not, Charlie. Which is, in retrospect, is pretty upsetting. But I wasn't prepared to throw away my last penny on just because I'm stubborn old bugger.
What was the final straw?
Our feed costs got out of control. We'd always had some control over them. I mean, even now I fill up our silos with grain if we had grain, and we could have battled on for a bit longer. But I'm 77. It's a dilemma that most independent family farms face at different times, I imagine. We came out of into this place here when we came out of New Guinea 50 years ago on a wing and a prayer. We were idealistic about it at the time and we were driven, and that got us through a lot of those early years. But they were tough.
Could you have seen it coming, the changes in the dynamic, the agricultural profile of the tableland, and the fact that feed was going to become so much more difficult to obtain and so much more expensive?
Well, the areas where they grew all of that corn, most of that country now is covered in avocados. So the old culture of corn and peanuts and spuds, that's all gone. And I think it's what they've got now is a fabulous mix of agricultural activities, and just shows you how brilliant Tinaroo's been. It's been an absolute bonanza. Anything you see around green on the table, at this end of the tablelands, is all because of Tinaroo, and the early tobacco guys that worked their butt off to achieve Tinaroo was enormous. The fact that there's no one's capable of making a determination to build any more dams up here is just about the dumbest thing you could imagine. It'll be different in another 50 years. There'll be other crops and bigger and better projects going on up here, but if they haven't got the water, forget about it. This is an agricultural community, and we live and die on water.
How do you feel knowing that pigs may no longer be a part of that agricultural mix?
I'm not distressed. I just think it's a sad moment for us. It's the way we've exited, these sheds are pretty confronting, but it's almost inevitable. Nothing stays the same forever. But that's only me. This hasn't been just me alone. My wife's been a very strong supporter of everything I've done here, as most small farming enterprises are. You'll always find a strong woman behind a successful fella, and that's what I've got.
But the mark you've left and the Greenwood family has left on the Atherton Tablelands agricultural sector, what do you hope will be remembered most about it?
We were honest producers and honest traders. We didn't hurt anybody getting here, and we'll eventually leave this land in a better state than we found it. And I'll have left behind a very good family. It's been a great run.
That story there from Charlie McKillop. And George and Terry Greenwood are bowing out after 50 years running the Atherton Tablelands' largest and oldest remaining piggery, and we wish them the best for the future.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
It's a species that I have been fighting for.
Growing up in the bush is such a special thing.
So when the rain does come, we've got a few numbers.
What if it never comes?
Put a feather in your cap.
ABC Radio.
Alex Hyman here with you on Australia Wide. Great to have your company. Cobalt Gorge in outback Queensland is now the home of Australia's first bridge built with an entirely glass surface. The $600,000 glass bridge, which was funded by the operators and the state government, was officially unveiled on the weekend with a ribbon cutting and traditional ceremony. Located in the Gulf Savannah region, Cobalt is a popular tourist spot, which is now more accessible to visitors, as Crystal Gordon explains.
The sandstone escarpments of Cobalt Gorge are now connected by a glass bridge, providing access across the gorge for the first time.
We've never had anything across the gorge, so the previous walk was literally just up the side of the escarpment. You got up to the escarpment and then you're able to look down the gorge. So now you can stand on the bridge right above the gorge, 19 metres high, look directly down and then look side to side and look up and down that gorge and then right on top of it.
Operations manager Hudson Fox hopes the bridge becomes a bucket list item, attracting tourists to the region.
We just really want to make the outback more accessible. People drive out here to see the gorge, and some people, you know, have to sit out on that walking element, because how the walk was prior to us opening the bridge, there were some difficult spots that some people struggled with. So with the bridge going in, it's just making that sandstone country a lot more accessible, so more people can actually come up and see the country for what it is.
Mr. Fox says the bridge could also become a challenge for tourists who are afraid of heights.
There's only 9.5 metres of actual glass bottom floor. It's opening up many things, not just the other side of the escarpment, but also for people that could come out and conquer their fears.
He says there were many logistical challenges with the project, but it only took 3 days to install the bridge.
Just with where it is and how remote it is, you couldn't really get cranes or anything like that in. We actually had to have a heavy lift helicopter with a maximum load of 1.5 tonnes to lift in beams that were 1.45 tonnes approximately, each beam, the ones that actually are the main support structure for the bridge. So there was multiple lifts with that helicopter, and then on and off leading up to the opening, we had multiple lifts just from our helicopter here at our Robinson 22.
Matt Bron from Tourism and Events Queensland says the operators are leading the way in outback tourism.
To put a glass bridge across a gorge in the middle of Gulf outback Queensland country, it's a massive wow factor. Innovation and new experiences are key to remaining relevant in the travel industry and in the tourism landscapes. For such a remote location, like the team that run Cobalt Gorge have developed this, is something that's really special.
Mr. Bron says over time, the attraction will help boost tourist numbers in the region.
They've done a lot of work at Cobalt Gorge over the years, including the first outback swim-up pool bar and their big infinity edge pool. It's a bit of a drive to get in there, but not hard by any stretch. To come along and see such world-class facilities, you know, word of mouth spreads, Instagram and pictures spread, and it will certainly be of help to get people into the north to spend their money in the communities that need the most. The travelling out there is part of a longer experience that you would do. You'd probably pop into some of the lava tubes that you can come across out there. There's Fossicking. Then you head on up to the Gulf where there's the Barra up at Corumba. So you can really start to put a really good little itinerary together through the Gulf Savannah these days. You know, this just keeps people longer in region. More to do, more reasons to stay, and once the photos get out there, more people should hopefully snowball through.
He says private enterprise and investment in tourism is vital for the future.
Councils and governments can only do so much. We need to back and get behind our private tourism operators so that they do start to, you know, dream a bit and expand their programs and their experiences, because they're the ones who ultimately deliver the outcome to the person travelling.
That report from Crystal Gordon there on Australia's first glass bridge, which has been unveiled at Cobalt Gorge in outback Queensland. Another spot to add to your list. And that's the program for this Tuesday night. Thanks so much for your company. My name is Alex Hyman. I'll be back tomorrow with more Australia Wide. Have a wonderful evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.